This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello, and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 9th, 1877, nearly a year after the Battle of Little Bighorn, Lakota leader Sitting Bull leads a band of followers, about 5,000 people or so, into Canada, hoping to find safe haven from the U.S. Army. Canadian authorities had promised Sitting Bull peace and protection from the U.S. Army. That lasted for a while, but eventually the group that had moved to Canada started to break apart, and Sitting Bull himself returned to the United States after 4 years. Soon thereafter, he would surrender to the U.S. Army, and not long after that, he would eventually be killed by the U.S. Army. But here to discuss that Canadian decampment and a little bit on the life of Sitting Bull in general are, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hey, Jody.
Hey there.
So I think we do need to start this with Little Bighorn and remind people kind of what happens there, because that really does seem to presage this decampment. That move to Canada. So Nikki, kind of what's the context with the Battle of Little Bighorn?
So I think it's important to note that there had been kind of a low-key war going on between various indigenous tribes and the U.S. Army for well over a decade by the time we get to Little Bighorn. And after the Civil War ends in 1865, a lot of that military power is redirected toward indigenous people. And in 1876, all of that military power notwithstanding, there is a battle between Sitting Bull's warriors and other indigenous people and an army group led by George Custer. And quite famously, that is Custer's last stand when he loses. The U.S. military is defeated by these indigenous tribes.
And it's a big loss. I mean, I think that all throughout history, this is noted as one of the most monumental defeats in which Native Americans bested, you know, America's best. And so this puts really Sitting Bull in a place of prominence, but also as a target, because now the number one fear is retaliation. Americans have to save face. They will not be defeated by Native Americans. And so really, after, as a result of this, Sitting Bull has to go on the run.
Yeah, and that sort of next year before then he goes to Canada is really one where you get this sense where there was just roving retaliation, retribution, because of the high-profile defeat at Little Bighorn.
Yeah, you can kind of picture it as almost a kind of a guerrilla warfare that's going on, where they're being hunted, but because they know the land so much better, they're able to avoid any kind of direct confrontation with the army. And ultimately, there is a meeting between Sitting Bull and Colonel Nelson Miles of the U.S. Army. And the army comes to him and is like, we are now willing to accept your surrender. And Sitting Bull's like, wait, I beat you. I don't think that's the way that this works.
No. Yeah. I give you the terms. You don't give me the terms. But I think that goes into just how much, like, you know, American hubris there was about, you know, Native American relations. It's this idea that even when we're defeated, no, that doesn't count. So here's how it's going to go. And yeah. I think, you know, there was a lot of this idea that they could still, that Americans could still call the shots, is what did not sit well with Sitting Bull.
Yeah. And so that meeting with Colonel Miles happens in late 1876. After that, Sitting Bull is, you know, effectively also still on the run a little bit and being hunted and also tracking buffalo and just trying to kind of find stability. And it seems as if, you know, what leads us to this moment in 1877, this move to Canada, is just an understanding that it's going to be very difficult to find any level of stability in the United States. So how is it that then Sitting Bull ends up being invited effectively into Canada?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So what happens is Sitting Bull and all of his warriors and people make their way to Canada because Canada makes a deal with them and basically says, hey, listen, we will give you safe haven if, you know, we can agree that, you know, we can keep skirmishes at bay and we can have good relationships. And Sitting Bull actually establishes a really good relationship with the Northwest Mounted Police Inspector James Murrow Walsh, who says, listen, we have mutual respect for one another. We want to make this work. And so for a while, it does seem that this will be a promising relationship in which, for the first time in a while, Sitting Bull and his people can find peace in a new place in Canada.
And we should note that these aren't the first non-white people to seek freedom in Canada. I mean, this has been something, part of the story of the United States over the course of its, at this point, 100-year history, is that while we tell a story of people coming to the U.S. to seek freedom, for folks like Sitting Bull, you had more opportunities to live freely in places like Canada.
You know, if you think back 20 years earlier, because of the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s, mm-hmm. African Americans are fleeing to Canada because it's the only safe space for them as well to not have to worry about slave catchers coming into Canadian territory.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe there's a Canadian equivalent of this podcast that we can do a crossover with to really get into the Canadian motivations right. here, you know, because I don't want to speculate too much, but it is interesting to see this moment where not only is it, well, we will welcome Sitting Bull to our country, but really we will offer you protection against the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a sort of larger political skim on top of this. And I'm just sort of fascinated a little bit by the Canadian motivations, other than maybe just a sort of moral stance of sorts.
Well, and also just geopolitics. Remember that for various indigenous tribes, they would play the different empires off of one another. So like in the French Indian War, when indigenous tribes sided with the French. And so there was this savviness about these relationships. And so you can see this could have just been, we see this as an opportune way to provide some peace in this region, or it could have been now we maybe gain a new ally mm-hmm. as we look at our relationship with the United States.
And the geopolitics of this all is one of the things that starts to then lead to this period coming to an end, because first off, this relationship between Walsh and Sitting Bull, at first that they're on the same footing, but then political pressures start to come in, and Walsh mm-hmm. in the American press, I think they were referring to Walsh as Sitting Bull's boss, but Sitting Bull didn't really like that sort of characterization. And then eventually the Canadian government started to pressure him and say, hey, you know, we've got to figure out a way for this man to return to the United States. So there was geopolitics, certainly, across all of this.
And the environment plays a role, too. I mean, the disappearance of buffalo is one of the big drivers for a lot of this roaming, and is actually a big driver for why, eventually, Sitting Bull comes back to the United States with the promise of food, in a lot of ways. That lures a lot of the people he's there with back to the U.S. and ultimately, after 4 years in Canada, brings Sitting Bull back to the U.S. as well.
I mean, you get this sense that over those 4 years, you know, the first year or so seems to be very stable. And then it's mm-hmm. the, you know, the environmental pressures, the political pressures, simply wanting to return back home. But it just seems like, you know, 15 people would leave the encampment, 20 people, 100 mm-hmm. people here, 100 people. Then all of a sudden, by the end, it's just a couple hundred people, I think, that are with Sitting Bull when he does return to the United States.
And mostly senior citizens, mostly the elderly and children and people who are not as mobile or able to move. But at this point, you know, Sitting Bull is just trying to preserve his people and make sure that they're fed and that they have, you know, basic necessities. And it was such a struggle to do that. Even when they returned to the United States, you know, the buffalo are all but decimated and their culture thrives off of the buffalo. So these are incredibly hard times for Sitting Bull to try to maintain just autonomy over his nation.
And of course, there's a campaign to wipe out their culture as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, knowing that they're going to reservations where they're going to be forced into a certain kind of lifestyle is about the cultural erasure, the decimation of the culture of the indigenous people. And Sitting Bull is very much aware of what awaits.
We should do another episode about the end of Sitting Bull's life. But, you know, just to add a coda to this story, he returns from Canada. I think it's 187 people at this point, and they do return to a reservation. And he does basically broker a surrender in exchange for amnesty for his people.
Yeah, he's assigned to Standing Rock Reservation in 1883. And, you know, times are still not much better for him. They're still not that much better for not just his tribe, but all of the surrounding tribes are constantly being embattled by American forces that are wanting to push them out and wanting more and more of the land. And so, you know, this becomes a really big issue, really up until like the early 20th century. These things are still battles that are being fought over Native American autonomy.
And for Sitting Bull himself, he has a pretty interesting coda to this Canadian refugee story. He comes back, as Kelly was just saying, and he eventually like joins up with Annie Oakley and some of these traveling Western shows where he is, you know, on display as really the probably one of the only Native Americans that most Americans will see when they go to these shows. So he becomes kind of a representative of Indigenous culture in Western shows. There's a kind of revival that goes on among a number of different tribes that worries the U.S. government and ultimately leads to the killing of Sitting Bull.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think definitely an episode on Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and yeah, sort of absolutely. Last few years of his life is in order. But let's leave it there for this episode, which again was on you know, this little Canadian, these 4 years in Canada. I want to do one little also on this day before we go. This is the day in 1912, May 9th, where Teddy Roosevelt called Taft a quote fathead. And I almost want to like do this show for the next 10 years and every May 9th just mention that, but never actually go into it and get more details, because I just feel like any more details are going to spoil it. I just want to know that Teddy Roosevelt called Taft a fathead and then move on.
I will add one juicy detail that won't please, spoil it, detail. And that is that Roosevelt also called him a puzzle wit.
A puzzle wit
and a fat head.
Okay. So. These are fighting words.
Oh, yeah. They were indeed.
Okay. Well, that does bring us to the end of the episode. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.